As I mentioned, my name is Nicole Henderson. I'll serve as your moderator today. But right now, I'm excited to introduce our trainers for our course today. They have all volunteered their time over the years with as ITRC members and helped with the PFAS resources and trainings, and including developing and delivering the training from today. So, on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC's PFAS and Biosolids: Sources, Occurrence, Transport, and Treatment. This class is developed as an offspring of the PFAS-1 Technical and Regulatory Guidance that was updated and published in January 2026. Included here is a list of the specific sections included in today's training on biosolids. You can reach all of these from the main PFAS-1 webpage, which is listed at the top of the slide, and I will put in the chat here in a minute. The training today features five discussions listed here on the roadmap. We're going to start with understanding the sources and types of PFAS in biosolids. Anthony from Weston Solutions will start us off.
Thank you very much, Nicole, and welcome to our training today, and good afternoon, everybody. Nicole said, this first part of the training, we're going to be talking about the sources of PFAS and biosolids. But first, I want to talk a little bit about general information about biosolids and some definitions that we use in the industry. Non-formally, though, biosolids and sewage sludge have been kind of used interchangeably in the past. But the EPA, US EPA, makes a technical distinction between the two terms. A biosolid is going to be a sewage sludge that has been treated to reduce the pathogens and meets the 40 CFR Part 503 regulations. A sewage sludge is going to be a sludge that is generally just processed from a wastewater plant and typically landfilled. But a biosolid is going to be beneficially utilized per that 503 regulation. The classification of biosolids is a biological process, or it's part of a biological process in reducing pathogens. It is not chemical based. So a class A biosolids goes under a process we like to call PFRP, or process to further reduce pathogens. And this material has gone through much more pathogen treatment than a class B biosolids. A class B biosolids goes under a treatment we like to call PSRP, which is processed to significantly reduce pathogens. A class A biosolids is going to have less restrictions for its utilization out in the field, while a class B biosolid does have further restrictions and requirements when managing it out in the field, and that's more about public restriction after land application events. But just keep in mind that the classification is based on a biological treatment and not chemical treatment. No matter the classification of biosolids, in general, the majority of biosolids are land applied or beneficially utilized. We do see roughly about 60% currently, but keep in mind that this statistic and this figure right here does not incorporate sludge that might be sitting in a lagoon or in some sort of temporary holding. This data is utilized from annual reporting and national surveys that have been conducted, but does negate the fact that there are sludges out there that have yet to be managed that could be going to landfill or be beneficially utilized, because sometimes when a lagoon is closed, that sludge may be beneficially utilized on site per part of the closure. But just in general, there are more biosolids being land applied today than there are being landfilled or incinerated. PFAS is entering into the collection system and impacting the wastewater treatment program and biosolid management programs through various different forms. You have your industrial inputs, so your metal plate finishers, your paper mills, your plastic and synthetic fiber manufacturers. Those facilities have been known to discharge PFAS into the collection system. The key thing about these industries is that they're typically controlled under an IPP program. Those are starting to develop across the country. Not every program has PFAS in their permit program, but as these rules start to develop, we may see that happen more and more often. But when you have an IPP program, you're able to monitor and actually put requirements onto that source for discharge into the collection system. So over time, the municipality controlling the wastewater plant will have better control of those inputs of PFAS. Unfortunately, though, the situation with the residential inputs is that there is no control. We don't have a IPP program for residential or domestic inputs of PFAS into the wastewater treatment system. And PFAS is present in some of our domestic products like cosmetics, food packaging, pharmaceuticals, toilet paper. And we'll talk a little bit about that down the road when we're talking about precursors. But domestic sources are passively they're passively going through the wastewater treatment system and impacting those end products from the facility. This is a table right here of the test methods currently right now that are validated. Keep in mind that they're mostly all aqueous or water liquid-based test methods. The 1633 method on the top there, that is the biosolid method that we are seeing in permits and other laws being passed. And so that method right now is a 40 compound list. It has been validated for 40 compounds. It's a terminal compound list. It does not include all the PFAS that is out there that's impacting the wastewater treatment system and the biosolids. So it does offer a limited picture of what is actually happening with the material. The bottom method there, 1621, is another method we're seeing inputted into NPDES permits that is absorbable organic fluorine. This test method will give you one test result, and it's an organofluorine compound or the organofluorine concentration in the sample. And typically that will give you a picture of all the PFAS that's in that sample. And that may include some other organofluorine compounds that maybe not be PFAS, but it does give you a good strong picture of the total amount of PFAS entering into the system. This is a great diagram where we have showing you over time how we've looked at PFAS and where our attention is on the compounds that are impacting wastewater treatment systems. To the right is a great diagram of the iceberg in the water where you have below just this huge mass of unknown in the top we can see. And that's really what's happening with PFAS and wastewater. In the initial stages, we were looking at PFOS and PFOA, and as regulatory programs developed, we started to look at other compounds. But really, what we're talking about today is the green and the blue there, that recent attention and soon to be attention. And those are precursors that we're noticing that have a greater impact onto the system that are not being monitored in other test methods. So, as we develop the understanding investigations, the impacts these precursors have onto the system is very important for us to understand. A group of those precursors that are used are polyfluoroalkyl substances. These are your fluorotelomer substances, your sulfamino substances, and your PAPs or your DiPAPs. They offer a weak link because there is some hydrogen bonding in that compound, but they make up potentially multiple different terminal compounds that further degrade over time through oxidation steps or even in the soil system after land application. And that'll be discussed in a little bit as we talk about that impact on land application. But these compounds have different charges, negative and positive and neutral. The 5-3 FTCA and the 6-2 DiPAP, we're noticing have a significant impact on wastewater. And one of the culprits we're thinking or we see in research is toilet paper containing 6-2 DiPAP. Here's a table that actually we'll talk a little bit about in the training a little later. But what I want to show you is there on the left, and it shows you how the A2 fluorotelomer can break down into its terminal compounds. So as we observe these precursors in wastewater and biosolids, we need to further understand over time how does that precursor break down potentially in soil and impact groundwater or further degrade through the wastewater treatment process and impact the influent or the effluent and the biosolid program. But this is just a quick little diagram to show you how that precursor can break down into those more terminal or those terminal compounds we have further understanding of and regulations on. For the occurrence of PFAS on a wastewater treatment facility, an important test method that has been used to observe this impact is top assay. Top assay is not a validated method, but again, is a very useful investigative tool when trying to source identify PFAS entering into the collection system. I've used it personally in my investigations and found some really eye-opening data to show when you're looking at terminal compound analysis versus this method here. But just from the Schaefer article, an interesting fact is that 66% plus or minus of PFAS organofluorine is in precursor form. And for 51% of that is in the effluent, and then 65% is in biosolids. So what we're seeing is actually there's not a full breakdown of those precursors as it's conveying through the wastewater treatment plant. So therefore, the effluent and biosolids are impacted with PFAS that are further going to degrade as they enter the environment. And that's something we need to further understand because as we land apply biosolids, are there impacts that we're not seeing today that we might see tomorrow? And we'll discuss a little bit about that later. That top assay method is actually shown a lot of, it's exposed a lot of PFAS that is traveling or conveying through the wastewater plant. And Schaefer actually identifies that there's a 2 to 3% increase after top assay was done on the influent and effluent. Now that is, the PFAS fluorine mass in the influent is statistically equal or greater to than the in the effluent than the influent. So at first when we were looking at data, a lot of people saw that influent data point being higher than the effluent being higher than the influent. And a lot of people thought that the wastewater plant was a source of PFAS. But really what was happening is that the PFAS was transforming as it moves through that treatment process, therefore exposing more terminal compounds in that effluent, making it look like the wastewater plant was a source. But really what it was is, again, transforming those precursors as they move through the facility. And an interesting fact that Schaefer brings up in his article in 2023 was that there's actually more PFOS mass leaving the facility in aqueous form than in the solids because of the sheer amount of effluent that is discharged from a facility on a daily basis versus the amount of solids generated in the biosolid program. Over time, though, we can say from data that there was much more PFAS in biosolids 20 to 25 years ago than there are today. The long chain compounds, the long chain PFAS compounds tend to sorb to biosolids and stay put there and lock right on. And as we've noticed in some soils at land application sites, the PFOS loves to stay at the top 6 inches and quickly drop off after that. It is site dependent, though. But we are seeing that decline over time of these compounds in biosolids. And hopefully, as these two compounds are phased out and manufactured away completely. But this is a very complex matrix of PFAS. And so, that there's about 77 and 97% of the total molar fluorine of biosolids is in these precursor forms. So, as those precursors break down over time, again, what is that impact onto the drinking water or the groundwater programs or groundwater under a land application site? I mentioned before that the 6,2 and 8,2 DIPAP precursors were detected in U.S. biosolids and wastewater. And again, it's about 77 and 97% of the greater molar fluorine fraction. And one article out there is suggesting that the 6,2 DIPAP precursor is impacting toilet paper. So, we need more studies to look into some of these domestic products and what is contained in the domestic products and how could that further impact, obviously, the wastewater treatment facility, the biosolid program, and the land application sites after land application occurs. But we have this overall impact that we're seeing on land application sites from biosolid land, PFAS impacts from biosolid land application. And over time, these sites have seen biosolids being land applied on a yearly basis. So what is that impact? Some of these sites that were former farms have now turned into residential properties that have drinking water or private water wells on the on those properties. So what are those impacts going to be? And you know, those Class B programs are going to have much more tracking than the Class A programs. So over time, you know, really, how do we see the Class A program tracking become better, and for us to be able to understand where the total impacts are? But on the right there, you can see how, you know, in the northeast and the north part, we've had a lot more guidelines about biosolids and PFAS impacts on biosolids than other parts of the states, and we'll start to see that grow as we obviously move into the future with PFAS regulation on biosolids. So just as sources, PFAS impacting impacts on wastewater collection systems goes beyond the industrial inputs. Understanding the domestic sources can, you know, continues to improve, but we need further investigations. Non-target PFAS analysis, you know, we're able to present, you know, that true concentration of that's in wastewater and biosolids. But, you know, as those methods get validated, how do we utilize those better? Domestic products contain precursors like DIPAP precursors, which have all been observed in biosolids at land application sites. And biosolid regulations vary across states beyond the 503 regulations, posing challenges for us to track these materials and how they are land applied. But with that, I want to pass it over to Harrison, where he's going to talk about the fate and transport of biosolids in land applied application sites.
Great. Thanks a lot, Anthony. And thanks everybody for joining us. I really appreciate it. I get to talk about conceptual site models or CSMs for PFAS at land applied biosolid sites. Then I got to zoom in a bit here and talk about the Vadosone processes. Those are really important for biosolid sites. Then I'm going to take a step back and talk about the kind of bigger picture field scale behavior. So the biosolids conceptual site model really starts with the application at the fields. So while land application of biosolids is a common practice for managing biosolids, it only results in a relatively small amount of U.S. agricultural fields having received biosolids. So as they're generated at a wastewater treatment facility, biosolids are in a liquid form. And so that liquid can be directly applied to fields with spraying or injection. But there's also pretty common practice of dewatering that biosolid so that it's in more of a solid form and can be spread on fields, like is shown in the photograph here. That's what spreading solid biosolids looks like. After the land application, then the biosolids, in some cases, can be incorporated into the soil through things like tilling. Really, the importance for the conceptual site model is that these different types of applications and tilling or not ultimately affects the distribution of PFAS in the soil. So you can imagine certain methods mix the PFAS in deeper into the soil, and certain methods may distribute the biosolids more evenly or kind of have concentrated spots. Like an example that comes to mind is that in some cases, biosolids, dewatered biosolids can get delivered to a site and placed in kind of a pile and sit there for a while before they're ultimately spread. And so that's kind of like a focused area of biosolids impacts compared to the rest of the field. This image shows different pathways associated with a PFAS land application CSM. And similar to a lot of other contamination sites, environmental media can play an important role here. So, obviously, the biosolids are applied to soil, and so soil is important. The PFAS can leach from soil into groundwater and ultimately into surface water. There can also be runoff directly into surface water, and sediment can be impacted. Biota are a potential interaction here, and there's also potential for PFAS to be in dust that can be blown in the wind. So outside of environmental media, there's some other media such as drinking water. You know, if groundwater surface water impacted, then drinking water can be impacted. There can be uptake from the soil into crops and crops grown as animal feed, and eventually there can be exposure to animals and impacts to the animal products. You know, if animals are eating impacted feed, or perhaps ingesting impacted soil, or drinking impacted water. Now, I'm going to focus in. I got to kind of go back to the top of the list here. I said I was going to talk about soil and specifically vadose zone soil, which is soil above the groundwater table. So, vadose zone soil, like is depicted in the cartoon here, consists of solid air and water, the soil moisture. And this is important for the fate and transport of PFAS in vadose zone soil because if the PFAS are stuck to the solid, then they're not in the water and they're not moving and leaching vertically. Kind of similarly, there's an air-water interface here. And if PFAS are stuck to that interface, then they're also not in that kind of bulk phase of the water and not available to leach vertically when water washes down through soil. I'm going to dive into three different important processes here. The first two, hydrophobic partitioning and electrostatic interactions, those are two associated with solid phase sorption. And then the air-water interface partitioning is obviously the air-water interface partitioning. I'm going to talk about through each of these in detail, but I wanted to highlight the chemical structure of this is a PFOA molecule. It's kind of a classic PFAS structure, perfluoroalkyl acid, and it's got that hydrophobic tail on the left and a hydrophilic head on the right. And that hydrophilic head, it's anionic, which means it has a negative charge. And so these physical and chemical properties imparted by the chemical structure come up a lot when talking about fate and transport processes. So for hydrophobic partitioning, similar to a lot of other contaminants, it's largely associated with sorption to organic carbon. And it's that hydrophobic tail of many PFAS that causes the hydrophobic partitioning. And with a longer tail that's more hydrophobic, tends to partition more. There's a lot of other factors that can also influence partitioning, including the soil type and the types of organic carbon. So certain carbons may behave differently depending on protein content or other properties. That brings up kind of a special consideration for biosolids, which is it's a really high organic carbon matrix, a lot of carbon in biosolids, but it's also kind of special. You know, regular natural soils have organic carbon largely sourced from breakdown of plant material. But biosolids have carbon largely derived from wastewater treatment facilities. And so they can have some special chemistries and properties. We're also dealing with relatively low concentrations for biosolid sites. And so partitioning can be dependent on concentrations. And so that's a special consideration. The other part of the solid phase partitioning is the electrostatic interactions. And so a lot of PFAS do have a negative charge, and a lot of surfaces, such as organic carbon and clays, also have a negative surface charge. And so those negative and negative, they repel each other. And so there can be reduced solid phase partitioning when those two negative charges are there. Depending on water chemistry, that charge can be kind of mitigated. So if there's a lot of cations in the water, or if pH is low, then that can help enhance adsorption onto solids because it kind of knocks down that negative charge versus less cations and higher pH can make the negative surface charge more prevalent and reduce adsorption potential. The impacts here are kind of special to biosolids. First of all, biosolids do have special chemistry with organic matter that might affect partitioning here. And there's agricultural practices such as addition of fertilizers that may affect chemistry. Really, the whole idea of adding biosolids and fertilizers is to change the soil chemistry. So the potential for affecting electrostatic interactions is pretty large here. For the air-water interface, this is an important aspect for PFAS because they have that kind of the hydrophobic tail and the hydrophilic head. And so they like to hang out at the air-water interface when they find one. That tendency to partition to air-water interface can be dependent upon, I guess, first of all, the different types of PFAS, but also dependent on water chemistry and concentration. So again, biosolids, agricultural practices intentionally affect the water chemistry. So there can be an interaction there, and we're dealing with low concentrations. So again, implications for partitioning to the air-water interface specific to biosolids. Now, without air-water interface, you don't have air-water interface partitioning. So you can imagine in the like below the water table where the soil is basically fully saturated, there's no air there, so there's nowhere air-water interface for PFAS to partition to. But as you get into the vadose zone, there's more air and water mixing, and so you have larger air-water interface for the PFAS to partition to and get stuck to. This in like a natural system is dynamic as you have rainfall and infiltration into the soil that can add water. You can have evapotranspiration, which dries out soils. So there's already a dynamic system there in natural systems, but biosolids and agricultural practices can really ramp things up. Management of soil moisture is a big part of agriculture. So things like irrigation, and cycles of crop planting and harvesting can have an impact on evapotranspiration. That's a little different from your more typical site. So this is good time. I wanted to take a little bit of a break and step back and do a knowledge check. And so the question here that we have for the knowledge check is, what are the three processes that we've highlighted that can influence the vadose zone partitioning of PFAS? So select one, select the best one. Option A is nonlinearity, hysteresis, and kinetics. B is pH, divalent ions, and surface charge. C is volatilization, non-aqueous phase liquid partitioning, and mineralization. And then D is hydrophobic partitioning, electrostatic interactions, an air-water interface. Give it a moment to have the results posted. I'm waiting on the results to be posted, I believe. And there we go. Oh, great job, everyone. There was a couple of quick trick questions in there, especially that option two. Those are relevant kind of aspects here, but it was really looking for answer D, the big processes we were talking about and reviewing here. Great job. So what I've been talking about mostly has been in the context of those perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA, the kind of classic PFAS structure. But as Anthony mentioned, there's precursors are can be really prevalent in biosolids, and these can have widely ranging physical and chemical properties. In a lot of cases, precursors tend to be more hydrophobic, and they're not always anionic. So that makes them often much more sticky, and they get retained in soil. So ultimately, an interesting effect is that for some precursor PFAS, the leaching is actually more a function of their degradation than it is the leaching of that PFAS themselves. So they may not really leach, but if they degrade into more leachable PFAS, then they move. I did want to touch on modeling PFAS and broke it into two kind of realms here. First is release scenario and setting. And then the second is hydraulics and transport processes. And I'm going to focus in on kind of the biosolids specific aspects. So for release scenario, biosolids are special because of their application scenario. They're spread over a large area and at relatively low concentrations. And another special consideration is that they can have multiple applications over time. For hydraulics and transport processes, special consideration is irrigation practices and potential changes in evapotranspiration with crop cycles. And then, as we talked about already, it's those special considerations with absorption to solids as well as the air-water interface ultimately affecting the leaching potential. Now, to talk through an applied example, there was this study of 10 working farms in the Northeast US, and it showcases a lot of the kind of fate and transport processes that we've talked through so far. So they did sampling of soil at different fields, and they found that there were tending to be higher PFAS concentrations at fields where biosolids had been applied versus fields where no biosolids were applied. They also found that higher concentrations were associated with biosolids that came from private sources that may include industrial inputs. They did collect soil samples at different depths, and they tended to see higher concentrations in the shallow depths of 0 to 6 inches versus the deeper 6 to 12 inch samples. And they associated higher PFAS concentrations with certain soil properties, such as organic carbon and pH. They also found that PFAS chain length was important. So the shallow soils tended to have much more longer chain PFAS. And then they detected shorter chain PFAS in some nearby streams, which indicated faster leaching of those shorter chain PFAS out of the soil and into the water. At one of the farms, they did do sampling of biosolids and soil for stream water for precursors. And kind of as unsurprisingly, picking up from what Anthony said, there were precursors present at significant amounts. So kind of reinforcing the importance of precursors at some biosolid sites. So in summary, really the CSMs end up needing to consider a large variety of different impacted media. Vadose zone transport and soil really is key, and there are a number of considerations that are special for biosolid sites, including the agronomic practices, organic carbon and soil chemistry specific to biosolids, relatively low concentrations as compared to things like AFFF sites, and a wide range of PFAS that might be associated with biosolids, including precursors. And so, as you heard, my voice is probably about to give up here. So, thanks for sticking through this with me. I'm going to pass it off to Chris so he can do a poll and talk a bit about the nature and extent of PFAS. So thanks, everybody, and enjoy the rest of the slides here.
Thanks, Harrison. That's right. Make sure I've got control here. Yeah, so now that we've heard a little bit about the conceptual site model and some of the small-scale processes that influence and control PFAS behavior. And we've know a bit more about the history and background of these sites. Before we went into the further end of the section I'm going to talk about, I wanted to just do a quick poll and see how familiar this topic is with our audience. Just get a feel for what kind of experience people have had with the topic. I'll give that a second to roll up. I'm going to talk a bit about some site-specific conditions, some of which Harrison has talked about, and then I'm going to look at how those might influence how you'll actually evaluate one of these sites if you get if you get handed one of these investigations. And wait, hold on. See what. Wait for that response to come up. Right, we got a fair mix of people then. Looks like just about 30% have had an AFFF or point source release, and about 40% of you though are going to be new to these investigations. And so what we're really hoping is that by the end of the training, you'll have a good idea of where to begin and some of the things you want to look at as you move forward with investigation of a land application site. And so I'm going to begin my section by actually returning to a previous ITRC training slide that we used as a conclusion, just to look quickly at some of the distinctions between land application sites and AFFF sites. So both are surface soil releases, and both site types are going to be strongly influenced by the vadozone sorption and transport processes that Harrison discussed. But the amount and the type of available data that you're likely to have at an agricultural field or a biosolids disposal site is probably not going to match what you might have had available at a military fire training area. And there's a number of other distinctions that are going to be important as you move forward with assessment of the sites. The two most important probably are that the concentration range at a land app site is most likely going to be quite a bit lower. Individual PFAS are probably going to top out around 1,000 nanograms per gram in soil, as compared to an AFFF source area where the levels might be 100 times that level in soil. And the other big factor is that your source area at a land application site might be tens to hundreds of acres, which as compared to an AFFF site that's only going to be perhaps an acre in size. And that's really going to affect the number of potential receptors that you may have to consider and other factors like whether or not you have adjacent surface water bodies and things like that. Another important factor is the composition and mix of PFAS, as it was discussed in the previous couple sections, related to wastewater sources. That source of PFAS is likely to be pretty variable in terms of what you might expect to find for target compounds. And as Andrew and Harrison noted, there's a high potential for precursors such as DIPAPs to be a significant portion of that PFAS signature. As compared to that compares to an AFFF site where if you have information on the product that was used or the years that they were active, there's a pretty good understanding of the chemistries for those legacy AFFF compounds, the C8 and the replacement C6 chemistries. All right, well, I'm going to look in, move forward now, and we'll look at a little bit of site data and considerations for investigations. So first off, I'm just going to go quickly through, based on the fate and transport behavior that Harrison covered, some hydrogeologic settings for these sites are going to be a lot more sensitive than others to leaching concerns. And to a lesser extent, those factors may also limit or enhance the bioavailability or uptake that you need to consider. For example, locations where the soils favor greater extent of air water interface and where you have a deep water table, leaching of groundwater may not be a significant concern. But locations with a shallow water table or perhaps finer soils, that may present a greater risk for leaching of groundwater and also for PFAS crop uptake concerns. And of course, where you have thin soils and a shallow bedrock groundwater table over a, you're likely to have enhanced impacts to a bedrock aquifer and potentially water supply wells. And the proximity to those water supplies, both public and private, is a significant risk driver. For example, the encroachment of development on farmland, that's certainly a factor in certain parts of the country. This small field here in the picture is a bit of an extreme example where you have a water supply actually located in a hay field. But even larger farm operations may have irrigation wells or livestock water supply wells that were located far enough away from land application activity based on the potential pathogen concerns, for land application, but they may not be located far enough away based on PFAS migration and groundwater. And finally, while you won't likely have the kind of geochemical or hydrogeologic data from previous investigations at a land application site, landowners may have important information, such as nutrient management plans that may contain soil pH, TOC, or cation data that would really help in your consideration of potential leaching. And they may have well construction details that can provide relevant information to your investigation, such as depth to bedrock or perhaps depth to the water table. One of the reasons that land application sites can be challenging to investigate is that biosolids can have PFAS levels that change over time based on a variety of factors, as compared to an AFFF mixture that may be somewhat predictable over that period of time. Andrew noted that both Class A and B biosolids may have variable PFAS based on changing inputs or sources, and that those PFAS levels may be variable temporally from a single source. Or you may have a single field that utilize multiple biosolid sources that can also contribute to variable concentrations at the field. This figure is adapted from the 2010 paper describing PFAS impacts in Decatur, Alabama, and shows PFOA measured in biosolids over a period of years where concentrations changed over orders of magnitude. So two fields that were licensed to receive that same source material in different years might have very different PFAS soil levels. And then the first study example shown here is a similar situation to the graph from the Decatur study. They had a location where they were able to look at soils and biosolids and detected 10^2 FTS frequently in the site soils, but didn't detect it at all in the biosolids currently available from that facility, which is another indication that those PFAS signatures are going to change over time from a single source. And the second example highlights how, if even across a limited study area, there may be a very different frequency of biosolids application on adjacent fields based on what crops are growing or what their license specifically allows. And that's going to complicate your investigations into potential PFAS sources if you're looking at a single farm or a localized set of fields. So, what do we expect to see for PFAS concentrations in site soils? The potential range of soil values is going to vary over orders of magnitude from sites with limited application rates or low PFAS concentration sources to those with a high frequency of application or biosolids with a commercial or industrial component. The figure here illustrates data from several different studies where soil values range from less than a part per billion to hundreds of parts per billion for PFOA and PFOS. And I'll step back just quickly to say that the prevalence of precursors and their importance to the sum of PFAS and biosolids and their potential as long-term sources of perfluoroalkyl acids was covered in the last couple sections. But I'm going to focus largely my section here on PFOS and PFOA site data, just based on the high frequency of detection, the regulatory criteria, and their importance to risk assessment. And for a little more context on the sites here in the graphic, study two was a site with 30 years of application history, but only with municipal inputs, and was located in the southwest US, where the water table is likely relatively deep. Site seven is the same industrially impacted site from the previous slide, and only had 7 years of use, but clearly had very high biosolids concentrations or PFAS concentrations during some of those years. And one final consideration is when you have sites where the soil levels are down around 1 nanogram per gram for PFOS, PFOA, or other individual PFAS, you might need to consider other sources such as pesticide, herbicide use, or even anthropogenic background levels, if the source identification is part of your project objective. Heard a bit about potential vertical distribution of PFAS in site soils. And in addition to some of the factors mentioned previously, that frequency of precipitation or frequency of irrigation is going to be important, as well as the soil chemistry and the soil textures all may impact the amount of vertical migration you find at a site. PFAS profile data is available in a growing number of studies, and just a couple of examples here. To give you an idea of the concentration ranges, for the 2022 study, PFAS at the surface was about 36 to 100 nanograms per gram in that surface interval, and declined to about 2 nanograms per gram at 10 feet below ground surface. PFOA at the surface ranged from 3 to 32 nanograms per gram and was near detection limit at that relatively deep detection at 29 feet below ground surface that they noted. With these high concentrations found in the shallow soils, if you're considering potential treatment, that's going to have to be focused on those intervals of the soil profile. But the large potential area of these sources is going to be a challenge for treatment. If you're looking at the suite of PFAS detected, those preferential sorption processes that Harrison talked about are really going to affect the suite of PFAS that you'll detect at any given interval within a soil profile, as well as transformation of precursors. Groundwater and surface water are almost always going to be a media of concern, especially if you have private or public water supplies nearby. And multiple studies have found groundwater impacted by leaching from land application sites. But the risk to drinking water supplies is really going to be site specific. And just because you have relatively high PFAS detected in shallow groundwater in or near a field doesn't necessarily mean that nearby water supplies are going to be impacted. This chart from the Maine DEP shows results for nearly 3,000 residential water supplies tested near land application sites and shows that even for wells close to land applied fields, only about 20% exceeded the 20 part per trillion interim standard for a sum of six PFAS that Maine is using. I will say many of those wells are bedrock wells, so there is some transition between the shallow groundwater table and the bedrock that's probably plays a factor there. Transport to surface water may involve dissolved PFAS and also PFAS sorbed to suspended particles. And that sorption to particles may enhance the mass transport through runoff during storm events to surface water. And recent studies of sites where municipal biosolids were applied found surface water concentrations ranging from less than 10 to over 100 nanograms per liter in water for PFOA or PFOS. And some individual PFAS may exceed 1,000 nanograms per liter in surface water adjacent to industrially impacted sites. And a final, I'll hit on again, if your site investigation is supporting an agricultural agency or perhaps an active farm, there's a multiple other media that may be of concern for uptake. And we're going to hear more about that potential uptake in the next section. So with the importance of groundwater as a media of interest, a major goal of any site evaluation is understanding the potential risk to groundwater, or perhaps for how long those concentrations might persist. Leaching studies can help answer those questions, and I'll briefly touch on some of those methods here. LEAF is a group of four methods developed through a collaboration of multiple partners. And the tests evaluate partitioning behavior, mass transfer, and extract pH effects on leaching. And they include some standardized data collection templates and some data analysis tools. SPLP, or synthetic precipitation leaching procedure, is another method that's been in use for a while. And New Jersey has developed guidance for using SPLP to compare PFAS data to screening levels on a site-specific basis for decision-making. And US EPA released additional guidance in 2025 about the use of SPLP and some modifications to make for PFAS analysis. Many of the relevant geochemical parameters are going to vary with depth in the soil profile. So, analysis over multiple depths, along with your total PFAS, might be needed to really make this kind of analysis work. And lysimeter studies can provide a direct soil to leachate concentration ratio, but sampling can be time intensive, and accurate leaching predictions are going to require significant effort due to the complexity of PFAS behavior in the vadose zone. So, despite the importance of precursors and non-target PFAS, most investigations are probably initially going to evaluate target PFAS using methods like a modified 537 or EPA 1633A. And I'll spend just a short amount of time here since some of this was covered in by Andrew as well. These are all methods that are applicable to soils or to biosolids. And the traditional methods may just be your starting point, depending on your project objectives. Additional analytical techniques might be needed if you want to assess non-target classes of PFAS for mass flux calculations, or if you're doing treatment evaluations where all those fluorinated species might affect your treatment performance. NMR and LC-QTOF are two methods that may help identify or quantify some of the additional classes of PFAS that are present in biosolids or land-applied soils. And these methods, however, might have higher detection limits that make them less effective if your concentrations in soil or biosolids are quite low. Like total fluorine methods, Andrew talked quite a bit about the TOP assay. They can be useful for screening or for developing mass balance assessments across different media. NMR can also be used for total fluorine, and the TOP assay, in conjunction with one of these analytical techniques, can help you determine if there's unidentified PFAS that may potentially transform to the perfluoroalkyl acids that are regulated in drinking water or that may be relevant to uptake. And of course, all these methods are discussed in greater detail in the ITRC tech reg document. So, one final consideration I want to touch on is when you're sampling land-applied fields, the soil heterogeneity is going to be a big factor in your data collection. Recommendations to farmers about crops or assessment of the risk a field might pose to groundwater requires having an accurate representative concentration for the entire field. Various studies have shown that nutrients such as phosphorus and potassium and soil pH vary by orders of magnitude across active agricultural fields. And because fertilizer, manure, and biosolids application methods are often similar, we might expect PFAS to vary in a similar way. In addition, as Harrison noted, typically biosolids are stacked in one location of a field, and that stacking location prior to being spread is also going to be a potential hotspot area. And so, for this hypothetical example here, where spreading created hotspots due to either the tractor path or field conditions or a stacking area, let's say the purple shaded areas are 10 times the PFAS concentration compared to the rest of the field. If you're doing discrete or even simple composite samples, you just may not get a reasonable estimate of the mean PFAS levels across the field. And to address that variability, one option is a systematic grid sampling and compositing approach based on incremental sampling methodology, or ISM. ISM traditionally involves a systematic sample planning and a gridded decision unit, and for some analytes involves drying, sieving, and subsampling at the laboratory. ISM will improve the accuracy of a mean value obtained for a field-wide concentration, and that's really going to improve your recommendation for future agricultural use of the field or for determinations of the potential risk of PFAS leaching to groundwater at that location. The grid example here would provide improved coverage of those hotspots. And it also shows how if you were doing only a small number of discrete samples, you might get some very uncertain or variable results. And collecting enough discrete samples to really cover a field is typically cost prohibitive for PFAS. A few states have adopted a grid sampling approach to address soil heterogeneity for field investigations of PFAS, including Michigan, Hawaii, and Maine, but the approach is not yet widely adopted. In addition, DOD has published some concerns over the use of ISM for PFAS investigations, particularly relative to the use of the full laboratory processing of bulk samples. So additional research is needed to address these concerns where ISM is implemented during investigation of biosolid sites. All right, so in conclusion, the history of plant application sites is going to vary widely, and so having site-specific information is going to be really critical to getting an accurate picture of what your investigation should look like. And because of that variable history, associated soil and groundwater concentrations also can vary by orders of magnitude, both spatially and vertically. You may need to consider test methods beyond methods like EPA 1633 if you want to fully characterize the soil and groundwater at the site. And sample plans might need to account for that soil heterogeneity and also to account for potential precursors enhancing long-term PFAS at the site. And I'm going to turn it over now to the moderator for a quick Q&A break for the first part of our discussion here.
Thanks, Chris. Yes, so thank you so much to our audience for your engagement to this point. The polls were great, and congratulations on completing those, as well as we do have many of our, we do have several subject matter experts in the background here answering your questions that are being submitted in the Q&A pod. So we are working on getting through those. We'll take a couple now here and spread them across our three trainers that have provided some information. So, Anthony, I will give Chris a chance to take a rest for a second, and I'm going to send the first two to you. With the first question being, why do some PFAS degrade? Aren't they supposed to be forever chemicals?
So for precursors, they are made up of multiple terminal compounds that are the forever compounds. So a precursor could have PFOA, PFOS, PFPEA, PFBS into it. And so therefore, when those precursors degrade, they break down into the terminal compound or the forever compound that is typically called PFAS, or the PFAS compound that is typically called forever. So the terminal compound, like or the precursor compound, like I was saying before, has weak spots in it, and those weak spots break apart, and then you have that forever nature left behind.
Great, thank you. All right, I'm gonna pull one more out of you if you don't mind. Are aerobic conditions typically needed for precursors to be transformed to terminal PFAS?
So, PFAS can break down through oxidative or reductive processes. So it's not completely always aerobic, but in like a wastewater treatment process, the biological treatment at a wastewater plant is typically aeration. So high aerobic conditions for that wastewater to go process through, and that's how those precursors degrade, or where those precursors degrade. But it's not in all degradation, it happens to be like that. But however, in wastewater, that is the big one.
Thank you. All right, Harrison, we hope your voice is rested because I'm going to ask to put you on the spot for a second here. Does organic carbon in soils affect transport of PFAS in the Beto zone?
Yeah, sure. So it does. It's like one of those important factors for the solid phase adsorption. And if the PFAS are stuck to the solid phase, that means that they're not going to be leaching through the soil. And like it does depend on the type of organic carbon, right? So the biosolids are rich in organic carbon, and it's that particular organic carbon that's derived from a wastewater treatment plant. So yeah, organic carbon is pretty important consideration for biosolid sites.
Great. Thanks. Let's do one more for you, if you don't mind. What are some of the factors that influence PFAS accumulation at the air-water interface?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I guess the first one is the PFAS itself. So, the different PFAS have different physical and chemical properties, and so things like the functional group and the chain length will affect how much it likes to partition to the air-water interface. The other aspect is the concentration of the PFAS, so that can affect how much partitioning occurs. And then there's the water chemistry in the soil, and so it can be affected by the ionic strength in the water, as well as concentrations of like organic dissolved organic carbon or other surfactants that can all kind of come into play into partitioning to the air water interface.
Thank you. All
Thank you.
right, we let Chris catch his breath, so let's put him on the spot here. So, Chris, for site investigation, what factors contribute to the PFAS soil concentrations being so variable across an agricultural field?
As with many things, PFAS, there's multiple factors involved. There's a group of factors sort of related to the sources, which would be the time period of application, the frequency of application, and the source of biosolids, as well as potential changes in PFAS levels at that known source. And then there's also factors related to the location or the site itself. Topography, soil type, changes in soil chemistry, and then physical factors like the method of application or perhaps a stockpile area that can really impact localized concentrations in soil.
Thanks, appreciate that. I think I have time for one more, Chris. I'm going to pass this your way. So, how are biosolids land application sites with PFAS impacts identified?
Land application sites get identified through a number of different ways. Sometimes through testing of soil and water supplies in some sort of organized, program. There's also testing of crops or agricultural products in some states, like milk or eggs, that can trigger a review of a location. And then sometimes just something as simple as a record review by a state agency might be identifying locations that were licensed for land application decades ago, or locations that may have received Class A amendments. Those are all ways that sites can come to light. In addition to one final thing would probably be because testing is more available now to individual people, sometimes sites come to light. Just through sort of volunteer testing of water supplies by members of the public.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Well, thanks everybody for the questions. We're going to continue to monitor the Q&A pod while we move on, just in the interest of time. We do have another Q&A break at the end, so we will continue to not only respond to questions, but compile them for this purpose. But let's move on to evaluating and modeling risk from PFAS in agricultural settings. And I'm going to pass this to Lisa from TerraPhase.
All right, well, thank you. Yeah, we're going to shift gears a little bit. We've talked about PFAS in biosolids, how to analyze for them, characterizing how they move through the environment, and looking at how to characterize nature and extent of PFAS at a biosolids site. So I'm going to be talking about what that means in terms of PFAS in biosolids and health risk. So I'm going to be going over some of the methods that we can use to evaluate potential risk of harm to human and ecological health. Look at uptake of PFAS in plants and livestock. I'll talk about implications of PFAS and biosolids for human health risk. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about the EPA's draft biosolids risk assessment. And then lastly, I'm going to wrap up with talking a little bit about risk to plants and livestock, which often isn't thought about in the context of the agricultural setting. So let's see if I can advance my slide. There we go. Okay, so before I launch into the rest of my talk, I wanted to give a very high-level overview of the risk assessment process. So that's the process through which we assess whether exposure can result in some kind of adverse health effect. So there you'll see five main components of the risk assessment process here on the screen, starting with hazard identification. So what are your contaminants of concern? In this case, we're looking at PFAS originating in biosolids that are applied somewhere. Dose response assessment are the toxicity values that we use to assess risk. There's great information about toxicity values, dose response assessment in the PFAS-1 technical regulatory document in section 7. Exposure assessment discusses how much a contaminant to which a receptor is exposed. And so that coupled with the dose response assessment allows you to make some kind of characterization of risk. So what are those risks relative to a regulatory criteria, risk management criterion? Exposure assessment and risk characterization are really the two components of the risk assessment process that I'll be talking about today. Again, lots of great information about risk characterization and PFAS. You can find that in our PFAS-1 document in section 9. And lastly, I just wanted to bring up uncertainty analysis is a critical component of the risk assessment process, which really discusses the uncertainties inherent in each of the individual steps. So we've seen this figure before. I just wanted a very brief reminder about the different pathways through which PFAS can move through the environment, and in particular, focus on biosolids applied in agricultural setting. So you can have direct impacts to soil, surface or groundwater, as has been discussed, but we can also have indirect impacts through uptake by crops and animals that eat the crops as well, including humans. Animals that graze in contaminated pastures, or even could be fish, for example, that live in impacted water bodies. And certainly, food supply impacts have been in the news lately due to identified levels of PFOS and other types of PFAS. So, I think a lot of the literature has pointed that both plants and animals can accumulate PFAS. And as with all things PFAS, uptake can be very sensitive to site-specific factors. And we need to be careful about making broad or general statements about uptake. There seems to be no one-size-fits-all. This slide and the next slide that I'm going to be covering a few different concepts that follow from the PFAS-1 guidance document and the priority topics document. Plants can take up PFAS from the soil that they live in, water, either in the interstitial parts of the soil column or through irrigation, as well as atmospheric deposition. So we typically think of PFOS and other longer chain PFAS as the main constituents that accumulate. However, longer chain PFAS tend to bind to proteins, and plants typically are water rich, but not necessarily protein rich, as we see with other types of organisms. So for plants, we actually see a preferential uptake of shorter chain PFAS. And once PFAS are taken up through the plant, they are translocated into the different components of the plant. So that could be shoots or leaves, flowers, fruits, for example. And you can have different rates of uptake in the different parts of the plant as well. So you may see a different rate of accumulation in the roots, for example, versus what you would see in the fruit of a tomato plant. And the longer chain PFAS, like PFOS, tend to stick around the roots, where you see the shorter chains that can easily move through water tend to be found in leaf stems and fruits. This degree of uptake can be represented by what we call a bioconcentration factor, or BCF, and that's the ratio of the concentration of a chemical in the plant to the ratio of, I'm sorry, to the concentration of the chemical in soil. And that BCF, that bioconcentration factor for plants, can vary significantly and really depends on a whole host of factors, especially with even within a plant. As I said, you can have different rates of uptake within the individual parts of the plant. But in general, these BCFs in plants range from approximately 0.1 to 10, but we do see considerable variability. And part of that variability can also be determined by soil characteristics. Chemical or physical characteristics like soil type, total organic carbon, pH, the presence of cations, et cetera, those can all influence how quickly PFAS is taken up and the types of PFAS that are taken up. So again, you see on this little chart on the right side of the screen, we see that the longer chain PFAS, so like the PFOS, for example, have a lower bioaccumulation potential in plants, whereas the shorter chain constituents have a higher bioaccumulation potential. Oops, sorry, getting a little trigger happy here. There we go. It's a little bit of a delay. Okay, so we talked about plants, and certainly, like I said before, PFAS in milk, for example, has been fairly big news recently. In animals and livestock, the pathways of uptake are primarily related to food consumption. So their feed, if they're foraging in a pasture. They could also be exposed by ingesting impacted water supplies. Incidental and intentional ingestion of soil is also relevant for livestock. For example, a lot of animals groom themselves, so they are, unintentionally ingesting soil particles. Some animals, such as poultry, will actually pick up soil particles and small rocks and things like that as part of their digestive process. So, and typically, you could also have soil attached to the food supply itself. So different types of pathways are relevant for livestock. The uptake and accumulation of PFAS in animals is contrary to what we just saw in plants. So shorter chain constituents are typically less accumulative than the longer chain PFAS. As I said before, PFAS, especially the longer chain PFAS, like to bind to proteins, and animals are protein rich. Most accumulation tends to occur in blood plasma, in the muscle tissues, and the fat tissues. Again, we do see quite a bit of variability in what the rate of uptake is and the degree of bioaccumulation. And that has a number of factors that contribute to that, notwithstanding, different digestive systems. For example, cattle have a very, unique digestive system compared to a chicken or a pig. The amount they're taking up, the amount of food they're accumulating relative to their body weight, a whole host of different factors can affect that. We can also see biomagnification occurring, especially these longer chain PFAS tend to increase in concentration the higher in the food the higher in the food web that you go. So upper trophic levels, like for example, a top predator or predatory fish might be expected to have higher concentrations of some of these longer chain PFAS. We do see an enhanced uptake of the perfluorosulfonates compared to the perfluorocarboxylates. And we do see some precursor transformation. We had talked about precursors earlier in this presentation, and you can have transformation occurring as well within the animal. Relative to bioaccumulation studies in wildlife, for which we have a fairly data-rich environment, for livestock, the studies are somewhat limited, particularly for as they relate to biosolids application in agricultural settings. There are a few studies out there showing that PFAS readily accumulates in chickens and eggs, in milk and other protein sources. Michigan, for example, looked at PFOS detected in cattle and finding PFAS at levels warranting a human consumption advisory. Similarly, Maine tested deer and turkey that had foraged on biosolids applied fields and found PFAS concentrations resulting in do not eat advisories as well. So, what does this mean for human health risk? The main exposure routes for human exposure with respect to biosolids specifically would be the diet. And, if you had a contaminated water supply resulting from that, that could also be a significant portion of your exposure. But by and large, for the general public, it's the food supply that we are most concerned with. Exposure can also occur through direct contact with the biosolids themselves. So, example, if you're gardening in land that had biosolids applied, you could certainly come into contact with that. But exposure via that type of pathway, that direct contact pathway, is typically less than that we see for food or water. So it's important to understand while humans can be exposed to PFAS and biosolids through these multiple exposure routes, the magnitude of the exposure really varies considerably, and diet is typically the primary exposure medium. PFAS have been found, or at least a subset of PFAS have been found, to have a relatively high toxicity. So clearly that leads to one question about what the risk is to human health. And again, I'd refer you back to Section 9 of the PFAS 1 document that talks about risk from PFAS. But that's a great segue into my next slide, which talks about the US EPA's draft biosolids risk assessment document that came out in a little over a year ago at this point. And so EPA looked at various scenarios where PFAS impacted biosolids might be applied to an agricultural setting and evaluated the risks from various exposure routes. So there were three in this draft risk assessment, there were three different types of farm scenarios. So there was a crop farm, and all these farm scenarios are basically describing a self-sufficient farm where a family lives adjacent to a land for crop cultivation or growing or livestock for consumption. The crop farm scenario is basically where the farm grows crops, so root vegetables, fruits, above ground vegetables. They could also be exposed through other pathways like drinking water, fish consumption, direct contact with soil. EPA also looked at a pasture farm scenario, and within that scenario, they looked at two different types of pasture farms. So a pasture farm is where they're growing animals for consumption, so cattle, poultry, etc. And one of the scenarios looked at an annual biosolid application, and the other scenario looked at basically what they call a land reclamation scenario, which is a one-time application. So, say you had a field that was fallow, they had an enhanced application rate to basically allow that field to be returned for pasturage. So those two, pasture farm and land reclamation scenarios, were focused on consumption of meat, milk, dairy, and eggs. Again, with the crop farm scenario, they also looked at these additional pathways such as fish consumption, groundwater consumption, so on and so forth. Lastly, EPA also looked at a surface disposal scenario, which basically characterized a sewage sludge unit, disposal unit. So biosolids would be applied to this disposal unit. And then from that, they predicted what underlying groundwater concentrations would be. So there was no dietary contribution to that scenario. It was just focused on drinking water. EPA evaluated the risk for all these scenarios using an assumption of one part per billion each of PFOA and PFOS. And one of the things that EPA noted is that one part per billion is not necessarily a conservative assumption on concentration of PFAS in biosolids, and could in fact be representative of a background concentration. Within all of these scenarios, EPA further broke it down into different types of exposure assumptions. So, looking at central tendency and higher end exposure assumptions, such as consumption rates. They also looked at different precipitation and soil sorption regimes and different rates of biosolids application. So, it's very complicated risk assessment. So, I'm going to try to summarize all that they did into one slide, which is very challenging. But in a nutshell, what they found was that one part per billion of PFOA and PFOS in biosolids resulted in unacceptable risks for farming scenarios. So what they did basically is they took their estimated levels of exposure, compared them to the toxicity values, and came up with two different types of risks. One reflects non-cancer effects. So, for example, it could be like liver damage, and that's represented by a hazard quotient. And then they also looked at cancer risk. So, that's the probability above and beyond background incidence of cancer resulting from exposure to PFAS and biosolids. And they compared those to the EPA's points of departure, which is a hazard quotient of one and a cancer risk range of 1 in 1 million to 1 in 10,000 excess cancers. They found that the pasture farm scenario had the highest overall hazard and risk. And the biggest risk drivers in general across all the scenarios, all the farming scenarios were, driven primarily by fish and milk for PFOS and by fish groundwater and milk for PFOA. Again, there was a lot of different types of scenarios evaluated, so these are very general conclusions. What they did find, though, is that site-specific factors such as hydrogeology, soil type, climate, the different agronomic practices like land application rates, and then behavioral practices like how much somebody consumes fish, how many tomatoes somebody eats, things like that. Those all factored into influencing the outcome of that risk assessment. So that's people. Let's talk a little bit about plants and livestock. So I, you know, in earlier slides, I talked about how PFAS can be accumulated into plants and animals. Certainly, we've documented PFAS exposure in both plants and animals as well. So, what does that mean in terms of their health? In plants, we do have studies showing that PFAS exposure can result in stress and issues with their response to stress. And we can see changes on both the cellular level as well as the molecular level. So on the cellular level, we might have structural changes in root cell organelles. We could have disruptions to cell walls. We could have hindrance of productions of new proteins, membrane permeability issues, issues with photosynthesis of plants, oxidative stress as well. So a lot of different issues have been observed as a result of PFAS exposure. And then on the molecular level, we found that PFAS exposure can result in how gene expression is influenced, especially with respect to stress responses. So in livestock, there's a number of studies in mammals, fewer studies in birds in general. A lot of those are your basic laboratory study, with a rat or a mouse. There are very, very few studies that look at direct impacts of PFAS in livestock. And in some of those studies, the exposure pathways that they, the sorry, the delivery pathway that they deliver PFAS to an organism might not really reflect what we would see in an agricultural setting. So, for example, a lot of the chicken studies or poultry studies out there might look at egg injection. Well, that's not really a viable pathway at a farm. It's really, what do we see from food ingestion or water ingestion? And some of the studies that are available really have had, a range of results. We don't necessarily all often see actual documented changes, so really no clinical significance as a result of feeding. But again, there's very limited data out there specific to livestock, so it's hard to make any kind of characterization at this stage. Especially when we have a lot of data about mammalian effects, I think in general these are focused, like, as I mentioned, on smaller animals like rats. Something like a cow has a very different anatomy than a rat does, so their uptake and elimination kinetics and can vary significantly. So I will wrap up my section. Basically, the main points to take across is that there are uptake factors available to model bioaccumulation. Some of those you need to take with a grain of salt in terms of what the uncertainties are and what the variability is across species, across soil types, et cetera. But we do have tools available to help us model and estimate risks. It's just important to understand, though, there's really no one size fits all approach, and you really need to understand, your environmental conditions, the limitations in exposure and toxicity data that we currently have, and then, as I mentioned before, species sensitivity can vary quite significantly depending on what type of organism you're evaluating, whether it's a person or a plant. So, with that, I will turn it back over to Nicole.
Thanks, Lisa. Appreciate it. Let's get queued up and continue on with our roadmap here and go into evaluating treatment and management options for PFAS and biosolids. With Tamsin taking over for us.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. So I want to step back first before we talk about treatment, just to reiterate the conceptual site model about how PFAS are getting into biosolids from this conceptual diagram where we have sources being discharged from industrial and commercial, from things like stormwater discharges that are receiving impacted stormwater from things like fire training areas, residential sources, which was talked about earlier. And then within the wastewater treatment plant, those PFAS are moving through the existing treatment. There is some precursor transformation, but by and large, the PFAS partition out into the aqueous phase of the treated water and the biosolids and get discharged. Once we have the biosolids, we've talked a lot about land application and how that's used and managed. But when we're looking at treatment options, you can manage the biosolids also by landfilling. And you'll see, notice that there's sort of a circular loop as the PFAS are discharged back into the landfill, create leachate. That leachate is often discharged back into the wastewater treatment plant. So there's sort of a cycling of the PFAS there, if you will. Or implementing some other treatment processes, which we're going to talk about in this section, including thermal treatment to actually specifically address PFAS. So when we look at managing PFAS and biosolids, our first priority and preference is really source control. It's preventing PFAS from getting into the wastewater treatment plant to begin with. So this includes things like pretreatment programs that can manage industrial discharges, manage PFAS coming in leachates. This is where you've often have the lowest volume, most concentrated PFAS. But again, because we have non-point sources like residential sources of PFAS still coming in, it's not going to address all of the PFAS impacts. Second, then, of course, is land application. We look at options for land application of biosolids that have PFAS impacts. This requires a detailed understanding of what those PFAS levels are and what the leaching potential is. That can define the requirements around the land application itself and what's permissible and what's not, and also help manage or mitigate or treat those biosolids that can prevent PFAS leaching, you know, retain nutrients, and then really treat or landfill the biosolids. We're going to go through treatment options in this case are mostly focused on thermal methods, which have, as you can imagine, significant cost implications. Oops, sorry, having. So, first option really is landfilling for biosolids. This remains a common management approach for biosolids. As of 2023, about 24% of biosolids were landfilled. Regulations that restrict land application may increase the need for landfill disposal. For instance, the state of Maine banned the land application of biosolids in 2022 because of concerns around PFAS. So now, most Maine utilities now rely almost exclusively on landfill disposal and long-haul transportation to manage biosolids. This approach is more costly, less flexible, increasingly vulnerable to regional market constraints. So if you're not land applying the biosolids, they have to go somewhere. And this requires planning, investments, and support from the communities. Requires management facilities. It requires landfills, landfill capacity, which is limited, and also challenges associated with biosolids, including things like they tend to be very watery. They need to be mixed with about four times their volume to bulk them up for disposal. And as I mentioned, the fact that the PFAS are still there, so they end up coming back out of the landfill in leachate and then getting cycled back through the process. There are now states providing guidance on biosolids management, also that may increase landfill disposal. Michigan, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont all have some sort of PFAS monitoring and sampling prior to land application for biosolids. So again, as impacts are more understood, the landfills, you know, may be relied on to manage PFAS impacts. So moving into treatment options, this is a table that summarizes the thermal treatment options for biosolids that are used, and sort of goes from left to right. High temperature processes like incineration, that really is the base case for thermal processes. Temperature ranges and oxygen content are important. That's highlighted in this table along with the products. And then the technology maturity. So then again, incineration is our base case. Temperatures are for destruction of PFAS have been shown to be needing to be around 1,000 degrees Celsius with 2 seconds retention time. Temperatures lower than that, some studies showing temperatures at 700, 800, or 900 show products of incomplete destruction byproducts, which is a concern. So when we look at other technologies like pyrolysis, that is a common technology for biosolids specifically. But it is at a lower temperature. It does produce things like char and syngas, which have a beneficial use. Gasification is another Again, it has higher temperatures. It also produces syngas and chars, supercritical water oxidation. This is relying on increasing both temperature and pressure to create a reactive environment to break down the PFAS, and then hydrothermal alkaline treatment. So first, again, our base case is incineration. It's important to consider that in incineration and the potential for products of incomplete combustion at lower temperatures. Again, the kind of sweet spot that has been identified is temperatures greater than about 900 to 1,000 degrees Celsius with a 2-second retention time to get breakdown and limited production of the products of incomplete production. That varies some based on the incinerator type, if it's a rotary kiln or advanced thermal oxidizers. Because of the concerns around incineration, however, in April 2022, DOD actually placed a temporary ban on incineration for PFAS because they were concerned about the liabilities and the potential for release of PFAS in the effluents of the incinerators. In July of 2023, they did authorize consideration of using RCRA-permitted hazardous waste incinerators for disposal of PFAS because they are typically operated at higher temperatures and under more, you know, robust conditions. In April of 2024, EPA updated their interim PFAS disposal guidance and considers high-temperature incineration as a viable option for PFAS disposal. So when we translate that to options for biosolids and we look at typical thermal processes like sewage sludge incinerators, about 14% of biosolids are managed. However, sewage sludge incinerators are typically operated at lower concentrations depending on their configurations. The multiple hearth furnaces operate from 300 to 500 degrees Celsius, fluidized bed furnaces from 700 to 800. And so, as you can imagine, they also have been shown to have variable PFAS destruction efficiencies. Higher temperature incinerators exceed the temperatures. These are things like the RCRA hazardous waste combustors, cement kilns, again, having the higher, greater than 1,000 degrees Celsius. They are also typically paired with air pollution controls like thermal oxidizers to mitigate the discharge of PFAS in the flue and the stacks of those systems. So when we look at options for incineration, this is a map that has EPA's RCRA-permitted combustors. There's municipal waste combustors. If you look at the orange dots, those are the 24 RCRA-permitted hazardous waste combustors in the U.S. So you can see that there's, again, limited capacity just with the infrastructure to incinerate materials. And when we look at volumes of biosolids produced across the U.S., that is a significant concern in terms of sustainability and viability of using that approach to incinerate and manage PFAS and biosolids. Sorry, y'all. The lag is throwing me here. So one promising technology, thermochemical technology for breaking down PFAS and biosolids is to use a treatment train, a gasification process to convert them into a clean biochar and hydrogen-rich syngas. And this figure kind of walks through what that process looks like in terms of preparing the biosolids, pre-treating it, implementing a primary thermal system like pyrolysis or gasification. So you're first drying the biosolids to a low moisture content. Typical temperatures are 70 to 200 degrees C. Pyrolysis is the dried material is heated to temperatures between 350 to 500 degrees C in a low oxygen environment. This breaks down the organic compounds, including some of the PFAS. Then you have a thermal oxidation step. This is a partial combustion to drive endothermic gasification reactions at higher temperatures at 800 to 1000 degrees Celsius, followed with a reduction process. At the end of this process, you end up with a syngas as well as biochar. Another technology that's promising is supercritical water oxidation. Again, at temperatures greater than 374 degrees Celsius and pressures greater than 221 bar, it creates a condition called supercritical, where there's extremely reactive species that then can break down the PFAS through various defluorination and radical oxidant reactions. This process is being applied commercially. There are several vendors and relatively large-scale pilot and full-scale systems that are being constructed in the U.S. now. The City of Orlando and the Orange County Sanitation District both have pilot studies where they're building systems that can process the 6 wet tons per day of biosolids. This technology is being applied currently. Downside to this technology is it does not generate byproducts for beneficial uses. It's really intended to just completely break down the material. And next is hydrothermal alkaline treatment. It is similar to supercritical water oxidation. It has slightly cooler temperatures. So it's about 350 to 660 degrees. It has high pressures, but it also has a caustic environment. It adds sodium hydroxide typically at pH 11, and in those in that chemistry, it has been shown to achieve near complete defluorination of PFAS in various forms. There is a current ongoing Department of Defense study looking at this technology to treat PFAS in biosolids that is showing some promise in terms of breaking down and treating PFAS. And then last, this is not a thermal treatment technology, but there is ongoing work in academic research and in industry to evaluate the efficacy of various sorbents and stabilizers to address PFAS-impacted biosolids. So in this case, it's relying on adding amendments like granular activated carbons or biochars that sorb the PFAS or modified clays. There's various components like Renbinds and Fluorosorbs. And the intent here is it's not breaking down PFAS or degrading PFAS. It's essentially binding it to prevent leaching. So in this case, you're binding it, you're preventing leaching, so you're mitigating the risk. You're decreasing its bioavailability to get uptake, but into organisms or into plants, and you're managing the leaching of PFAS with those amendments. So there are a number of ongoing studies at the bench and in some limited pilot scales showing promise in terms of reducing PFAS leaching from biosolids where these amendments have been applied by a factor of, 90, 99% reduction in leaching. So with that, I will turn it back over to Nicole.
Thanks, Tamsin. Appreciate that. Us over to before we get to our last Q&A break, I did want to just kind of promote additional PFAS webinars that are hosted by ITRC. We have two additional brand new trainings coming up this spring that are currently open for registration, one on beet transport in March and one on the sorption-based technologies coming up in April. Additionally, we continue to host our PFAS introductory training and our PFAS chemistry explaining training. All of these can be found on the ITRC website at itrcweb.org. go and navigate over to the training section. So with that, we have made it to the end. We'll do our final Q&A. I'm also going to share the feedback form for those that are interested in the certificate of completion. You'll go back to this web page, scroll all the way down to find the feedback form. Again, you want to make sure that you check the box in the lower right-hand corner that certifies that you participated in the training, and then the certificate is emailed to you. While we give Tamsin a break, Lisa, I'm going to revisit a couple of questions we had for you first.
Sure.
What are the primary exposure pathways for livestock to be exposed to PFAS from biosolids sources?
So similar to human exposures, those exposure routes would be from typically from food sources, so grains or pasturage, or even some of the like high protein feedstocks that could be like fish-based, for example. Ingestion of PFAS in their drinking water could be significant if the drinking water source is impacted. And then, as I mentioned before, just ingestion of soil, either intentionally or incidentally, is also could be a potentially significant pathway. But for, among all those different exposure routes, it's really food that's probably the biggest source of exposure if to make a, a categorical statement. Other types of pathways typically are much lower.
Thanks. Let me send one more your way. In which parts of plants are PFAS most often detected?
That again, I feel like everything I say is, well, it depends. And it depends with plants. There's a lot of variation in how plants, how plant, what their growth form is to begin with. And then that affects how they can take up contaminants, including PFAS. So with PFAS, it really depends on the type of PFAS you're looking at too. So like I said before, like your longer chain ones tend to not get through the outermost portions of the root, for example. So if you're looking at and then you could have shorter chains that are, or the more water soluble type PFAS, it could be more readily taken up and distributed to leaves or fruits or whatnot. So if you're looking at PFOS, for example, your highest concentrations might be in, say, a carrot peel. But if you're looking at some of the shorter chains, you might have higher concentrations in leaves and stems and fruits.
Thanks. Great, Tamsin, thanks so much for your section as well. Just pull you back in for a second. What are the treatment options for biosolids prior to disposal or land application?
Yeah, so as we discussed in my section, when we are looking at treating the biosolids themselves, there are, some limited options. Most of them are the thermal processes, things like incineration, the gasification, supercritical water oxidation, hydrothermal alkaline treatment. Those are being applied at larger scales and at the scales that would be needed for biosolids. Also, the option of stabilizing PFAS in the biosolids, both as an option for permitting or managing disposal at like non-hazardous or municipal landfills, depending on PFAS leaching characteristics of the biosolids. As well as for application or to achieve the ability to land apply the biosolids.
We have time for one more here. Are there treatment options to remove the PFAS but retain the nutrient value of the resulting material for fertilizer?
Yeah, that is certainly an important consideration. There's been a lot of work done to develop biosolids, right, for its nutrient value and to increase sustainability and to really use it as a resource. And so the nutrient value, the phosphorus, the carbon, the fertilizer, are all important components. And in looking at sustainable management in the future, developing approaches that allow us to continue that beneficial reuse is important. And so there are processes like pyrolysis, for instance, that really was developed and designed to heat and dry the biosolids in an oxygen-free environment that does retain a significant amount of the nutrients like the phosphorus, the iron, other elements, the calcium, magnesium that can be important for plant growth. But again, you have to balance that with how much thermal and how much treatment is needed to remove the PFAS. And as I mentioned, we often have to significantly increase the temperatures to achieve that. And that does reduce or break down a lot of the nutrients in those products. And so there is a balance in how you manage that and understanding how those nutrients will be retained in the materials, especially if you're looking at producing biochars and other things that would be have a beneficial use at the end of the process.
Thanks, Tamsin. We've had an amazing response to our Q&A pod here, and I will apologize that we will not make it through all of the questions that continue to come in. What we often try to do is pull the questions and develop a Q&A feedback that we'll post with the archive of this training. So you still have questions that have not been responded to, please give us some time to continue to get responses out to you all. Since we have a minute or two here, I'll call out to trainers, and if you see any in the pod that make for a better verbal response right now that I'm not seeing, please feel free to speak up. All right, while we wait for that, I did want to say that it seems that the feedback form right now is not working. It may be that it will become active as soon as this training ends, so you can try again. Otherwise, we will submit a support ticket to get that fixed. The link does stay active, so you will be able to revisit and submit the feedback form after we close this. You're welcome to try again in 30 minutes or so. Otherwise, if we have a significant challenge getting that up and running here as soon as we close this webinar, we will try to send an email to all that are registered. But you will have a chance to revisit the website, access the feedback form, and get the certificate of completion even after we close this event. If you have continued problems getting the certificate of completion, please email us at ITRCweb or at ITRC@ITRCweb.org. Is our email address, I think. All right, well, with no additional feedback, thank you so much to our trainers. Thanks for our audience for joining us. Again, this has been recorded. It takes about a week for us to archive, and you will receive an email when it is available. Thank you all. Thank you, trainers. Have a great day.